you like this episode, please subscribe, share with others, rate and review so we can continue to bring you great programming.
Welcome to Inclusion Catalyst. We invite diversity leaders to the table to deconstruct complex social justice issues and showcase the best inclusion practices in our workplaces and our communities.
What's up, everybody? This is Julian Geiser from Great Heart Consulting. My pronouns are he, him, and you're listening to the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. The goal of each episode is to give people the tools and resources they need to create inclusive environments that truly reflect the diversity of our modern workforce. I sit down with various agents of change to discuss the ideas, the opportunities, and the strategies that need to be implemented to effectively bring that change. Today is June 27th, and as we close Pride Month 2022, it would be understandable if we focused on how ephemeral recent and critical gains made by the LGBTQIA+ community feel in light of current judicial decisions being handed down, decisions that are almost certain to curtail these important gains. Today, we're choosing to focus on and celebrate the beauty and resilience of that community, on the strengths that have helped them attain greater equity and recognition in spite of rife discrimination and hate. To help us do this, we're excited to have Lily Zhang joining us. Lily, the pronouns are they, them, is a diversity, equity, and inclusion strategist and consultant who works with organizational leaders to turn their positive intentions into positive impact. A dedicated changemaker and advocate named the Forbes D&I Trailblazer, 2021 DEI Influencer, and a top voice on racial equity, Lily's writings and opinions have been featured in the Harvard Business Review, the New York Times, and on NPR. They are the author of Gender Ambiguity in the Workplace, The Ethical Sellout, and most recently, DEI Deconstructed, Your No-Nonsense Guide to Doing the Work and Doing it Right, coming this fall. Lily holds a master's in sociology and a bachelor's in psychology from Stanford University. They live with their wife in the San Francisco Bay Area and can frequently be found putting together yet another all-black outfit and enjoying good Chinese food. Welcome, Lily. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Julian. It's great to be here.
And I can see you. The audience won't, but I can attest that you've got a great black outfit on today.
You know, actually, my pajama bottoms are gray, but you can't see those. Clearly, my bio is lying.
I appreciate it. Well, thank you so much for joining us. As we get started today, I was hoping you might share some of the aspects of your identity that are most important to you.
Sure. That's a great question to start. Where to begin? I have lots. So I'm a trans person. I am non-binary. I use they, them pronouns. Depending on the time and space, I have also identified as trans feminine. I identify as queer, second generation Chinese American. And why don't we start from that? Those are some important ones to me.
Thank you for sharing. I really appreciate you sharing that with our listeners. So today we're here to talk about the resilience and strength of the LGBTQIA+ and gender diverse communities. First, I really want to recommend the book that you co-wrote and published with Dr. Allison Ash Fogarty in 2017. That's called Gender Ambiguity in the Workplace, Transgender and Gender Diverse Discrimination. I've read it in prep for our conversation today, and I found it to be a fantastic primer for those that are looking to learn more about gender. And the research that you conducted through personal interviews, I found to be incredibly humanizing and compelling. So with that plug in place, I'm curious, what were some of your core takeaways from the research and the writing of that book? Any particularly impactful narratives or personalities that you came across?
Yes. So for listeners, Gender Ambiguity in the Workplace is a compilation of interviews that Dr. Fogarty conducted as part of her research. And we talked to numerous trans folks in the Bay Area to really understand, you know, the wide range of experiences in this community, and, you know, looked into what they shared with us to analyze how being trans can result in so many different workplace experiences. The workplace was our focus here. We wanted to see, you know, what conditions that trans folks experienced at work, how trans folks navigated the hiring process, the process on the job, and so on and so forth. Now, to summarize some of our findings, what we found was that people's identities had really strong influences on their workplace experience. So whether somebody identified as a trans woman or a trans man or a butch lesbian or a non-binary person, all of these folks had very different experiences. And we started trying to identify similarities and differences between people's identities and people's experiences, and got a really rich amount of data detailing just the minute ways in which gender changes, you know, some of the most basic ways of how we're treated at work. So, you know, just to talk about some of those findings, we found that non-binary people, for example, were pressured at work to just pick one gender, one binary gender. This was the name of one of our chapters, Just Pick One. And it was really striking how frequently the non-binary folks we interviewed talked about this experience. They talked about workplaces in which they identified themselves with they, them pronouns, and their managers would say things like, okay, well, we can't have that. Like, I'm happy to respect your gender, but please pick man or woman, right? And that experience, keep in mind too, that when gender ambiguity was written in 2017, the research was, you know, from quite a years prior as well. That was before the non-binary identity was as well known in society. I think, you know, at the time of our conversation in 2022, at least more progressive audiences will have some experience using they, them pronouns and non-binary pronouns in general. But at the time writing this book, I mean, I personally didn't even identify as non-binary when we were writing this book. There are very few people who I knew who identified as non-binary. And so it felt very much like a fringe identity, a very unpopular identity, and one that most people didn't understand. So that was one core finding. Another one was that there was clearly a, I won't say hierarchy, because that's not the correct word, but there were clear differences in experiences between trans men and trans women. Mm-hmm. Particularly, we found that, you know, trans women experienced vastly more negative outcomes than we were expecting. They experienced, you know, interpersonal violence. They experienced, you know, outright prejudice, discrimination, getting fired from jobs, being unhirable, etc. While, you know, trans men, you know, on average had a more positive experience. Mm-hmm. We can trace these back. I don't want, by the way, I don't want people's takeaway from this conversation to be like, oh, Lily thinks trans women always get treated worse than trans men. But I think the core takeaway here that comes through in the book is that the more people are perceived to be challenging traditional gender norms, mm-hmm. the worse they get treated by people in positions of power and everyday people in society. And right. So to the extent that we found that trans women were getting treated worse, it was because there was a greater flouting of gender norms that was perceived by the people doing the discrimination. Everything comes back to these norms. And I'm happy to talk a little more about that with you, Julian. There's so many rich findings in this book. So I'll leave folks with that for now.
Yeah, I really appreciate that story, or what your work, but also like your reflections on it. And some of the things that you mentioned, I kind of, you know, picked up on myself. And you had said that you didn't want to talk about hierarchy in terms of, you know, who gets treated better or worse. But it did seem that it was clear that there was, you know, that there was this like this progression of you know, people that identified as butch women or presented as such, that as long as, you know, that they typically were treated better and that they like kind of could enter the boys club in some mm-hmm. ways up to a point, right? Like up to a point, like, and if they went too far or stepped over line, like they would get like reminded of their place, I guess, so to speak.
Right. You're talking about Parker.
Well, right. Yeah. So exactly. So Parker was someone who I had written down that, you know, this he's a white trans male who, you know, his experience of discrimination was really mostly correlated to his pre-transition, like his time before he transitioned, when he was really viewed more as a butch woman. Mm-hmm. And then as soon as he, you know, he had left, he had gone through his transition and come back with new pronouns, a new name, and had this like completely different experience of the workplace. And so that was, you know, that was like one of the stories that really struck with me. And I think, you know, when we talk about the case for D&I, like, it's unfortunate that people are still asking us to make it, but we spend so much time in the workplace, in a workplace setting, that I felt like this particular, you know, the approach of studying it from this perspective is so appropriate and like telling of people's experience of discrimination, not just in the workplace, but also outside of it, you know, whether it's in friend circles or in other organizations or, right, you know, wherever people go, wherever people are.
So I have lots of thoughts on that. The first one being, you know, these kinds of reflections are one of the reasons why so many sociologists like studying trans people. Because trans people are seen, rightfully so, as sort of border crossers, boundary crossers, mm-hmm. people, you know, whose experience of gender is different from cisgender people who typically stay in the box that they've been assigned since birth. Mm-hmm. And through their experiences of crossing these borders, of crossing these gendered boundaries, many sociologists who study gender believe that trans people's experiences can teach us more about gender, not just for trans people, but for literally everyone. Mm-hmm. And looking into Parker's story, you know, one other point I want to make is that far too often when we think about trans people in the sort of common public perception of trans people, our story only starts when we transition. Mm-hmm. And it was so apparent when we talked to Parker, this white trans man, that his story was so much more rich and complex than his gender transition. In fact, you know, his gender transition was almost boring.
Right.
He went on T, he transitioned, and he was treated like one of the guys. And then he pretty much didn't have anything more to say after that. He was like, things were good. I was one of the dudes. Do you want me to keep talking about how good things were? Like, like I was just one of the dudes. I didn't have to think about things. And instead, Parker just, you know, shared so many things about like, okay, well, if you want to hear about discrimination, let me tell you about when I identified as a butch woman, when I didn't even, you know, have an inkling that I was trans. And he gave us such a rich and nuanced discussion on how butch women or masculine women are treated in the workplace, the sort of unspoken rules governing, you know, people perceived to be masculine women, and then the experience of people perceived to be masculine women when they become even more masculine, mm-hmm. whether, you know, out of gender transition or not. We actually had a couple, we had some more people in the research who were also butch women, mm-hmm. and became more masculine, just not out of gender transition. They kept their pronoun she, her, but they, you know, wanted to become more butch. And right. they faced like, you know, threats of violence and
yeah.
rape and horrible things.
They crossed that line,
right? So yeah. Parker's experience basically, you know, alluded to this invisible line that masculine women face, where if you brush up against it, if you get close to it, mm-hmm. if you're clearly a woman, but you're just, you know, a woman that's kind of more masculine, more bro-y, acting like the dudes, you get benefits. Mm-hmm. You know, really get benefits compared to more feminine women. But if you cross that line, even for a moment, if you, you know, try to pretend to be something that you're not, quote unquote, right, then you start to get in trouble. And right. I think that's such an interesting experience, because that's not just something trans people face. Right. Like this is something more core to mm-hmm. how the gender binary functions in our society. And I find that fascinating.
Yeah, I love that point, because I think if people, you know, people that identified as, you know, that are cis and identify with the gender with which they were assigned when they were born, were honest about the pressures they face to conform with their own gender. You know, in terms of, well, this is, you know, I identify as cis and male. And so for me, like, I felt a tremendous amount of pressure at times to like say, like, this is all that is possible, right? There's like a lack of recognition that
absolutely
that it can be a spectrum, right? That I can I can be, you know, I can be I can be a strong man and think about legacy, but also like really want to like look at my partner, my wife, and see the ways in which, you know, she caringly mothers our three children. And want to like recognize and say, like, I don't feel like that kind of care is accessible to me. And part mm-hmm. of the reason it's not accessible is because I've been socialized that like I have to be the disciplinarian, or I have to be, you know, the hard, you know, hard ass. I think I can say ass anyway. So, you know, it's the binary feels so limiting. And I think it does get us into this, like this next question that, or one of our next questions is this idea of like, just the complexity, like this tension that we're like, it feels that we're constantly managing for in between simplicity and complexity. Because I think, you know, this idea of the gender binary, our commitment to socialization, to gender essentialism, really seems at the heart to be about simplifying something that's way more complex. And, yes. And complex things are beautiful, right? And so, and then, but at the same time, what I feel that trans and gender diverse people are really asking for is something really fundamentally simple, right? Which is to be seen, heard, and believed, most of all. And so, yeah, I don't know. How do you, what are your initial thoughts? I mean, I know you've wrestled with this tension, I'm sure, a lot. And I'm just curious, like, what are some of your ideas around it and maybe ways in which you've thought about managing it?
So this is the tension that every advocate faces. Mm-hmm. The desire to present a community in all of its nuance and all of its complexity and in all of its contradiction. Mm-hmm. And the enormous pressure from society to prevent, or rather to present, a very simple, oversimplified reductionist narrative. Mm-hmm. When I talk to folks about trans people, they have very, very simple questions. They say, what do I do to make trans people feel better? Why is it that trans people are discriminated against? Who is discriminated against? Am I a bad person? And these are all very like, these aren't bad questions. They're simple. But whenever I start my answer with, okay, well, you know, to answer that, we need to start thinking about gender. People start to disconnect. They say like, well, yeah. I don't want to think about gender. I want to think about trans people. Right. I want you to tell me the one fun fact about this weird, wacky community so that I can fix things. And that's just not how it works. That's not how it works with any community. And I think, you know, something that you mentioned earlier, Julian, is that the experience of trans people is fundamentally an experience of gender. Mm-hmm. And gender is a universal experience. And so if we can look into the experiences of trans people and see in them, in us, you know, I'm trans, mm-hmm. A mirror into our own experiences of gender, if we can look at trans people and use their experiences to recognize just how limiting the boxes of gender are around all of us, mm-hmm. that is the way we actually create a better society. But that's threatening.
Right.
That's terrifying. I've talked to so many people who are like, well, trans people upset me because my entire life, I thought I had to do this. I mm-hmm. had to play by these rules. I had to always go into work wearing makeup, or I had to always present myself in feminine ways, right? Or I had to stop myself from showing emotion. I couldn't wear the clothes that made me happy. I had to wear, you know, t-shirt and jeans every day, which I hated. And seeing trans people live their truths is making me angry because I realized that I could have all of those years ago. I hear that response a lot, wow. Right? And I think it's something that we need to look into. We need to say like, look, you know, I don't want us to think about trans people as this exotic community off in the distance that has its own separate issues. I want us to think about trans people as our siblings, as folks that are deeply, deeply close to us, whose experiences are just the flip side of our own. Trans people are who we could be if our experience of gender was a little more expansive, if we didn't keep ourselves in those boxes.
Right. They are those that we care about, right? They're here and amongst us. And I don't know, I don't like how I said that actually. That feels really othering. I think they're people who haven't felt comfortable because of the intense scrutiny and expectations of being socialized.
One of the things I say frequently is that a lot of transphobia can be rooted back to people's own relationships to their own gender.
Right.
In that, you know, there's a lot of projection. I meet, you know, several folks that are upset that trans folks are breaking rules that they've internalized their entire life. And the way they resolve that cognitive dissonance is to engage in discrimination to try to make trans people toe that line. rather than looking inward at themselves and realizing mm-hmm. that it's they themselves that can be more expansive and more gracious with their own experience of gender.
So what I hear you talking about a little bit is like this, the intense gender socialization that we're all subjected to. And I think that was one of my core takeaways from your book is that, you know, it's, and I've known this, right? Because I have my own experience of being socialized and I've thought about it. One of my core takeaways was that that privilege is really, it's a powerful force, but it's also super subjective. And it's, you know, it's this like systemic house of cards because the power dynamics and the hierarchies that we structure, that we're socialized to accept and conform to, they feel really superficial. You know, they're based on like these judgments about appearance, and, you know, what we wear, how we speak, how we walk. You know, one of the stories, someone talks about, you know, how they started, you know, walking differently, you know, that typically men walk with their shoulders upright and like very focused and in a very directed way. And
I did that in high school when I transitioned. I was watching walking videos and, on the walk home from my bus stop every morning. Whenever I was alone, I'd be like, how do I walk like a girl? And I like literally worked on that.
I did a couple local errands after I read that. And I was like, well, I'm going to try swinging my hips. You know, I was just like, it felt liberating to know that there are different ways to be in the world physically, you know, even something as like simple as walking, or the ways, and, you know, I spent 6.5 years in the military, and there were very specific ways about how you walked and marched, and, you know, that you would hold things in your left hand so your right was available for saluting and all this, like, you know, I've had like a pretty intense socialization around how you walk, you know, which just seems, you know, maybe practical in some ways, but also really limiting in a lot of ways as well. So
Even something as small as that, right? Like people associate so many things to even the most minute of gender expressions. Mm-hmm. And we talk about this at length in the book, but really what defines a person's reaction mm-hmm. to another on the basis of gender is this idea called sex categorization. Mm-hmm. Which is that every time we look at a person in the world, we sort of make a snap judgment based on all of their characteristics that we can see to say, are they, quote unquote, these are all, you know, made up concepts, biologically male or biologically female, mm-hmm. right? So we look at someone, we say like, oh, you know, what does their face look like? What is their facial structure? Do they have facial hair? What's their clothing like? What's their posture? How do they walk? How do they talk? And we make a snap judgment. And then on the basis of that judgment, we say, okay, I'm reasonably certain you are, quote unquote, a biological male. Well, that means I see this person wearing a dress. So I'm going to perceive you as a biological male wearing a dress. And then that is tied to a whole bunch of associations in my head to say, oh, then you must be deviant. You mm-hmm. must be a cross-dresser. You must be, I don't know, a horrible person. You must, gosh, right? Like want to... Looking to corrupt society, right? And like all of this from like, I don't know, looking at someone like across the street, like 50 feet away. Right. Like
wearing a piece of clothing,
wearing a piece of fabric. Like we just do this. We mm-hmm. just do this with everyone, everywhere. And, you know, you can catch yourself doing this. You can look at a person and realize that, like, you haven't said a word to them. You haven't interacted with them. And in your head, you've already given them a gender. You've given them an identity. You've ascribed characteristics to them. And that's kind of how humans are. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that we have to act on our beliefs to impose our own ideas of these rigid boxes onto people that we've never even met.
Right. Yeah. Well, I feel like we've given a really generous overview of some of the things that are some of the core characteristics that do contribute to the resilience and strength of the trans and gender diverse communities, because that's a, you know, dealing with that kind of judgment and bias on a day-to-day basis, is a lot. And so I'm wondering, you know, your perspective as we wrap up Pride Month, you know, what do you see as some of those core characteristics that have and continue to contribute to the strength and resilience of those communities?
It's community, yeah. Right? Like, I don't know any trans person who is in isolation and happy. Mm-hmm. I think the way in which we take care of each other allows us to be strong. The ways in which we show up for each other, to provide community for each other, to provide mutual aid and support and caretaking. I'm a trans person. During COVID, you know, I feel like our social circles just got smaller and smaller. Practically everyone I know at this point is trans. Like, you know, we find each other, we support each other, we take care of each other. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I have witnessed so much resilience in the last few years. I've witnessed so much in the last 10 years of my life. I've seen, you know, people show up for each other recovering from surgery. I've seen people run errands for each other when we feel unsafe. I've seen people, you know, sharing their you know, pills with each other when folks, you know, lose access to healthcare. Mm-hmm. Just the amount of like physical, emotional care provided within community just can't be understated. We take care of each other, right? Like trans folks have always taken care of each other.
Right. Well, I appreciate that. I think that's a beautiful testament to what it is that we're celebrating, you know, this month. So thank you. Well, I'd love to talk as we kind of get towards the tail end here of our conversation, I'd love to talk a little bit about allies and advocates in the workplace. So, sure. You know, those that like that want to make a difference. And I think your post from today, I thought did a great job of, you know, laying out 5 questions for where people might start, especially as they think a little bit about the SCOTUS decision that was handed down on last Friday.
Well, now that you say that, Julian, you're going to have to link that post when this podcast.
Yeah, I will. I absolutely will. I will. Like, I've been like trying to like think about what I want to, you know, how I want to elevate it because I thought it was so good. But what are, you know, outside of that post, which I absolutely will cross link. What are some of the things you think people can do to, you know, start, stop, or keep doing to advance greater equity for members of the trans and gender diverse communities?
It's a great question. And I want to take an unconventional angle in my answer.
Yes, please.
I think a lot of times when people talk about allyship, it's framed in terms of what you as an ally can do for the trans people in your life, which drives a very interesting set of behaviors. Right. I see folks who want to be good allies essentially make a beeline for the nearest trans person they are even like the faintest acquaintance with and badger them with all sorts of well-intentioned questions about like, oh my gosh, can I use your pronouns correctly today? And it's just, it's very weird. Yep. It's extremely strange. And as a trans person who spends lots of time with trans people, we just avoid people like that. We don't like interacting with people like that. Like it's just, right. You know, people just have an agenda and they just approach a trans person like where there's sort of moral get out of jail, you know, free card for the day. And it's mm-hmm. very strange. So instead of saying, you know, how can you support the trans people in your life? I'm going to take a different angle. I want people to think about how they can design systems that any trans person can engage with and have a more positive experience than at present. Mm-hmm. And to design a system, right, that's a pretty broad, vague term, you need to basically understand how to build effective organizations, how to create inclusive team cultures, how to have conversations in respectful ways. And you need to be able to do all this even if there isn't a trans person in that environment, such that as soon as a trans person comes in, it's already set up for success, mm-hmm. right? Like that environment is already set up for everyone to thrive in it. I like to use the example of like, when you get hired at a new company, usually, I guess, usually in person, if you're getting hired in person, there's a desk waiting for you. Usually there's a chair waiting for you. Usually you have a station to work. Right. What would that experience be like if you worked, you know, you got hired in a company and they said, okay, well, now that you've been brought on, we're going to think about buying some tables and buying your stuff. And you're just going to have to stand in the corner for a little bit while we get things ready for you. It wouldn't make you feel great at all. It wouldn't make you feel good. No. It wouldn't make you feel supported. And yet when we talk about marginalized communities, We very often frame our support as soon as you see someone struggling to have a hard time, make sure you step in and tell them how much you care about them. No, We can just make it so they never have a hard time, right? Especially if you live, if you operate or work in an environment with no out trans people, then great. You have an opportunity to make it so that by the time a trans person ends up in that environment, you can actually, you know, earn their feeling of belonging. You have created a space where they feel good.
Right.
Rather than saying, you know, well, I don't have to do anything yet. I'll wait until someone has a traumatic experience to start giving a damn.
Well, I love that advice. I love your approach, partially because I think one of the outcomes is that people, the tendency would be reversed. Instead of approaching someone that they identify or, you know, think looks like they might be trans, they have to do like the internal work of looking at what's existent and do quite a bit of education of themselves, right? They have to like take responsibility and accountability for their own learning and education, and look critically at the existent structures and system. So thank you. I liked your reframe.
And look, you know, if people know trans folks and those trans folks haven't approached them yet, like what makes you think that like they're going to have a good time if you approach them going like, hey, I just was listening to, you know, the Inclusion Catalyst podcast and you know, I'm going to go talk to a trans person for the day, right? Like if I was that person, I would be thinking about the 10 fastest ways I can leave this conversation in the next minute.
Right.
We can't center ourselves as allies.
Yes.
We need to center the impact required to benefit communities. And sometimes that impact requires that we look beyond just satiating our own desire to feel like a good person in the short run.
Right. Thank you. So this is, we're getting to the end here. This is Inclusion Catalyst. So I've got to ask, what's one example of something you've seen an organization do recently that's really catalyzing change and greater inclusion?
Well, I've seen some companies recently focus on giving the spotlight and the mic to their trans creators, their trans users, their trans customers, and essentially saying, you know, we don't want to speak for you this year. We don't want to, you know, say that we know what you're thinking. So we're just going to give the mic over to you. We're going to have you share what you want to share. You know, this is going to be time for you. You can share positive experiences, negative experiences, critical experiences, whatever you want. Because at the end of the day, you know, we want to support you and leverage our resources to do so. I find that very interesting. I also see, this isn't flashy or sexy or glamorous, but I see more organizations these days focusing on, you know, making sure their workplaces are more trans inclusive than they've been historically. Right. So I've seen, you know, more gender inclusive bathrooms, mainly because in some states they're now legally required, but I'll give some companies credit for following the law. And I've seen, you know, more companies do more to provide trans inclusive healthcare and benefits for their employees. All of these things are critical.
Right.
And sure, I've seen people focus on pronouns more, but pronouns are kind of the, this is going to get me in trouble. Pronouns are the red herring, I think, in terms of actual things to do to benefit trans folks. I'm not saying that you shouldn't care about like gendering trans folks correctly, but you know what trans folks need isn't for people to just use the right pronoun in one conversation. They need workplaces that don't discriminate against them.
Right.
They need societies that aren't violent towards them. They need lawmakers that don't, you know, target us with violence for just existing. And, you know, that's all hard. Achieving that's hard. But introducing yourself with your pronouns is easy. So there's just a lot of it's a lot of focus right now on that. I don't think it should be either or, but I want people to realize that there can be a real tendency to give ourselves a false sense of security with these individual micro level interventions, when what trans people need are macro level systemic structural change. And that requires movements of people. That requires that we like really focus on the big factors that are genuinely hurting trans communities every day, and we mobilize to get behind them. So I want to see more of that. I don't want to stop seeing people using pronouns, but I don't want us to stop there, right? Do not stop at the pronouns. Don't pat yourself on the back for the pronouns. Get the pronouns right, and then move on to the 99 other things that our communities need to truly experience well-being in society.
Right. Thank you. And then finally, before we let you go, I would love to have you tell our listeners where they can find you online.
Sure. Well, I have a prolific LinkedIn presence. I post 3 times a week. You can find me there. You can also find me at my website at lilyzhang.co. And for folks who want to keep up with my latest work, I encourage you to check out my new book, DEI Deconstructed, Your No-Nonsense Guide to Doing the Work and Doing It Right, which comes out in November 2022. We're coming up on it. It's getting close. I'm really excited. It is chock full of practical advice, and I hope it will be a useful resource for anyone who wants to learn and, more importantly, do DEI effectively.
Wonderful. Thank you. I've really enjoyed this conversation and our time today, Lily. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your perspective, experience, and insights with our audience. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. Thanks to Lily Zhang for joining us for an honest and great-hearted discussion, and thank you to our listeners for spending this time with us. We hope that you heard something of value and that it helps you to lead more inclusively. Do you know anyone that needs to hear this message? If so, be sure to click that share button. You can connect with me, Julian Geiser, and Great Heart Consulting on LinkedIn. As always, thanks for listening to Inclusion Catalyst.
You can bring your stories to the table as a partner and a host on the Inclusion Catalyst podcast. Visit inclusioncatalyst.com and click the link that says join us as a guest host.
And that's it for this episode of Inclusion Catalyst. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and share with your friends and colleagues.